Good afternoon, Winnipeg. You're listening to 101.5 FM here on UMFM. My name is Ryan Funk, here with you on UTalk. It's a program where we talk to individuals and organizations from across Canada, highlighting the diversity and amazing people that can be found here. Today, we're going to be talking with two organizations that help Indigenous peoples across Canada, the Art for Aid Project and Raven. Art has been an integral part of civilization since humanity's genesis, sharing massive epics of heroes, capturing the essence of life around us, or telling a story about our world or personal journey. However, if some don't have access to the supplies or resources they need, we may never see the world's next great prodigies. Art for Aid is a not-for-profit organization that does just that. Put art supplies in the hands of those who have none. Colleen Gray is both an artist and the founder of Art for Aid. She discusses the importance of sending resources to remote schools in Indigenous communities.
Back around 2012 or so, when Teresa Spence was up on Parliament Hill and she was fighting for better living conditions for her people at Attawapiskat, there was a lot of media attention in Attawapiskat at that time. And so I was watching this, and I noticed in the background of every media presentation, there were a lot of kids watching TV. And so I started wondering what, I don't know a lot about remote community life. And I do know that there are struggles, but I'm sure that there is more to it than that. So I went and started digging at the schools to find out what kind of resources they had available for their students. And that's when I discovered that there's a very limited amount of quality art supplies available to students, and certainly not a diverse amount of art supplies. And so as an artist, that really bothered me. As an Indigenous person, it really bothered me. I thought there's got to be some equal ground here. Then I discovered that Indigenous students receive 30% less funding than all other students. So that really lit a fire under me. And I started Art for Aid in 2013. I just reached out to a few friends and I said, listen, here's what I've just learned. And here's I'd like to do something to try to address that. And within a couple of weeks, my basement was so full of art supplies, I couldn't even move down here. That was pretty wild. People responded in spades. And so I've been doing that for about 9 years now. And of course, it has grown in reach and scope and diversity. But it's definitely the heart of the project is to ensure that there are quality art learning tools and skills labs in schools for children. Teachers are often out of pocket if they want to do a special project with kids. They often have to take that money for themselves because it's just not in the budget. Everybody knows that the arts are the first thing to get cut. And so unfortunately that's the case in Indigenous communities as well. So that's what I've been doing. I collect art supplies from people, I sort through them, and I rebox them and ship them out. We try to connect with as many schools as we can. The website shows a very comprehensive and detailed look at the schools that we've shipped to. There's quite a few. 2020 really slowed things down for us with COVID. We immediately stopped shipping out. The last thing we wanted was to be a vector for a virus reaching a remote community.
Yeah, no one wants to be that.
No one wants to be on that road. So that meant I had a lot of art supplies on hand. And so we were working to contact some of the band offices and principals at schools to just see if we could ship some relief supplies. Being in lockdown in an isolated community, you're going to lose your mind after a little while. So we wanted to make sure that the kids had something to do. And of course, we weren't able to meet all the need, but we were able to ship to a few schools and try to lighten up some of the isolation load for the kids and the parents too, right? They certainly could use the distraction of having their kids with their head down in some art supplies. But yeah, so that's pretty much how it is. It's a national project. We are now working under I Love First Peoples, which is a registered Canadian charity. So as a project working under a charity, we are able to provide official tax receipts now, which is something that we weren't able to do before. I Love First Peoples is also a national organization. They have a huge, huge reach. They've brought the Grizzlies movie to many communities, Indian Horse. They brought that movie into many communities. So they've traveled across Canada quite extensively and have made some wonderful network contacts with these communities that fortunately Art for Aid gets to capitalize on some of those contacts and reach out and get programs like so-and-so into these schools.
Yeah, a great symbiotic relationship.
It's wonderful. Yeah, they're a phenomenal organization. They work very, very hard. I mean, we all do. And they're like me, they're volunteers. They don't get paid either. So we're all doing this for just because it needs to be done. Somebody has to do it.
Yeah, it's great to hear that you and others stepping up to, you know, help those in need. And especially for like budding artists, like we never know who the next great artist is going to be if we don't give everyone an opportunity to shine.
Right? And you can't do that if you don't have tools. There's the art that these kids can produce is just incredible. I mean, these are some talented youth in these communities. But it frustrates me to no end that they don't have the ability to be able to tap into some of that creative potential to the same degree that kids here in Ottawa or Toronto or any of the other major cities are able to do. I wish we could change that. It's a big wheel to turn, but we're doing it a little bit at a time. You know, there's a lot. There's a really big.
Yeah. So what are some of the next steps? You know, you help ship some art supplies out to these remote communities, but how do we kind of like build on that as just combined communities, you know, to help out these people in need?
Oh, you know, there's so many ways to do that, Ryan. Anybody can look on your computer and find a school. Just open up a map. You know, you can just Google Indigenous Schools Canada and you'll come up with a huge list of them. Contact any one of these schools and ask them what they need. The Rotary Clubs have been fantastic. They have been very, very supportive of all of my projects. And, you know, they're always looking for ways to help. Right now we have in Garden Hill First Nations, the school there, one of the teachers there has reached out to Art for Aid and asked if we could provide them with some library books. They didn't have any books on North American animals. They had lots on African animals, on European animals. And the gentleman, Ivan Harper, who reached out to me, he is a teacher who runs a land language program in the school. And so he takes kids out on the land. So he was really frustrated with the inability to actually take a book and show his students what a wolverine might look like if they hadn't seen one, or what a moose or a cougar. So we set out to try to help him with that, and I sent it out. I have quite a large social media network that really helps up. They really step up and help. So I sent it out to them, and I told them that this was going to be a direct ship. And so which means Art for Aid would not be shipping it out. Normally people would send me the art supplies and then I bundle them into big boxes and we send them out. So this would be a direct ship where people would ship directly to the school at Garden Hill. And so it looks like they're going to get an awful lot of books. He's also requested like small plastic animals to show as models so that the kids could see different animals in Canada, killer whales, for example. You know, in Garden Hill First Nations, it's not likely that they're going to see a killer whale float past their front dock. So, you know, that like that is really a useful resource for an instructor in a school. So that's just one of the things that we've been working on recently.
Yeah, for people not in living in remote or rural areas, like we kind of take that for granted that like, oh yeah, we just have access to all of this. And just to hear about, you know, kids not being able to have books of animals that live here in Canada, that's kind of mind-blowing.
Yeah, pretty basic stuff, right? And you don't, you know, when you have access to this stuff, you take for granted, you know, that you're going to be able to just jump on your computer and pull up whatever you need. Some of these communities don't have internet access, so they can't even really do that. Resources are, you know, I mean, to me, having the available resources goes hand in hand with every level of education. You can't just draw a picture of a killer whale and have a child connect to it the same as they could a model or an image in a book where they could learn more information. And I think that's really limiting. I think our students in remote communities are having their education curbed by having a lack of, or not having the proper, sorry, let me start that over again. I think young people in remote community schools are having their education limited due to a lack of resources, such as proper books and proper examples of things like animals or fish or bugs. And these things are great. Kids love to learn about stuff like that. They love the natural world. So why shouldn't they have these resources available?
Exactly. And I mean, hopefully, you know, conversations like this can help put an earwig in people's ears to, you know, get inspired and help out and, you know, support initiatives like Art for Aid and others that help, you know, people who don't have access to technology or information.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. Access to technology is really important. There's very limited broadband infrastructure in many of these communities, but that's changing too. You know, there are positive turns happening with that. I don't know if you're aware of this, but recently Pikangikum First Nations just had an interaction with Elon Musk and his organization, Starlink. And somebody petitioned Elon Musk to come to the community or to put broadband in their community. And they did it. So they now have Starlink internet access broadband in Pikangikum First Nations.
There's also a new project that is happening with, you know, Genome Canada and the Isle of First Peoples and... Art for Aid. You're working on creating sewing skill labs in remote communities. What can you tell me about that?
Yeah, that's a real, we're so excited about this. I could talk about that all day. So a couple of years ago, to begin with, I'll let you know, I've been shipping out art supplies for 9 years now, but I never visit the communities where I end up shipping the supplies. And the reason for that is because it's really expensive to fly. It's like $1,000 just to get on a plane to go to a remote community in Canada, if not more. And I can ship a lot of art supplies with $1,000. Like we just, to give you an example, like shipping is wildly expensive. And I ship through Canada Post. Just yesterday, I sent off a shipment of 12 boxes to Garden Hill First Nations. And that was a $758 shipment. So it's not cheap. To try to get sewing materials, like we, when I went to, let me start that over. When I started working with I Love First Peoples and they discovered that I've never been to any of the communities where I've shipped art supplies to, they decided to alleviate that. So they took me up to Natwashish in northern Newfoundland, and there I got to meet the teachers and the students, and I ran the Earth to Sky program up there, which helps young people connect through art to the natural world and to offers them a bit of insight of how an Indigenous artist sees through the eyes of art and Indigenous spirituality. And so when I was there, I got talking to the teachers about what would they like to see. And so we started talking about a sewing program, and I Love First Peoples and Art for Aid began to collaborate on a project and with some really incredible volunteers, and the Rotary Club jumped in and helped us. We managed to get three perfectly good, beautiful sewing machines and about 150 pounds worth of sewing materials, notions, thread, bobbins, peripherals, right down to a repair kit box with all of the tools needed to repair a broken machine if need be. So we got all that shipped up to Natwashish. They were very excited, and I think one of the news outlets ran a story on it, and so they were really excited. And so we made a commitment to go back and revisit the program and see if there was anything we could need. Could we upgrade them? And they said that they would, you know, they were really loving having the machines, but they wanted to teach their elementary students how to sew. And these machines were big machines. So not really suitable for little fingers and not safe for little fingers. So I did some research and I found Janome Canada made a wonderful machine for kids. So we reached out to them and this is what we decided to get this machine. But Janome, when they looked at the machine that we had selected, they said, you know, that machine is not going to hold up to the rigors of elementary school education being used over and over and over again. So they upgraded the machine. So initially, the machine that was going to cost us $160, they upgraded to a $900 machine.
Wow.
Yeah, it was a wow. And so further to that, when they decided to sign on board with our so-and-so project, they committed to giving us 60 machines each year for the next couple of years. And then we would take a look and reassess the program and see where we're sitting and see how successful it is or where we could make improvements. And then we'll see, you know, how it unfolds from there. So we have four communities this year that we're going to be able to put sewing machines into. People were very generous and jumped on as soon as we started putting out the ask for funding to buy these machines. People were very quick to help us out. So we were able to amass between Janome's donation and what we were able to raise through fundraising. We're going to be able to service four schools in Northern Canada. So one of those schools is to be determined, but the others are we're going to put the elementary students, the elementary program in Natwashish, Pond Inlet, and Nain Labrador. So
that's so amazing.
It's so exciting. So we're going to be able to ship out the machines in probably May or June. Janome is also putting out a request for materials to their network. And people will be using collection points in Toronto to be able to get materials that are going to be donated. We're going to try and find a location here in Ottawa as well so that we can also collect and people can contribute here in Ottawa. We're looking at launching the program in September with all four schools. And so, yeah, we're just crazy excited about it. It's just great. We can't wait to do this.
Yeah, that's just fantastic.
Thank you.
So what are some other initiatives or projects that your organization is hoping to accomplish, especially as, you know, restrictions ease during COVID-19?
One of the other things that we've just started initiating was we've begun working with the Bateman Foundation. Robert Bateman, who doesn't know Robert Bateman, right? He's an incredible Canadian artist, wildlife artist. And the Bateman Foundation has begun working with Art for Aid to bring remote community schools online learning. So what they do is they provide the materials for the student that wants to learn, and they teach students online how to create a good quality sketch. There are three levels to the learning program. The third level is a more intensive learning program that a student can achieve certification to become an instructor. There's just so many different things that the Bateman Foundation is working towards with Art for Aid. And we're really excited to be able to offer online learning to remote community students with the incredible team at Bateman Foundation. They've got some phenomenal artists. So that's pretty exciting.
It sounds like it.
Yeah, it's really great. We haven't got, I don't think we have any schools signed up yet. We've got a couple of potential schools, but nothing concrete. So if there's any teachers, educators out there who are listening to this cast and are interested in getting linked up with the Bateman Foundation, if you have some students that might be interested in doing some online learning with their amazing artists, and it's all free, there's no cost to the school. please connect with us at Art for Aid, and we'll be more than happy to get you together with them. Let me see, what else are we doing? I think that's it for now. I think I've probably got other plans in the hopper, but nothing's coming to mind right now. But I always have all kinds of ideas that I jot them down and I put them in my ideas folder. And, you know, I'm sure like at some point I'll be having a cup of coffee and go, holy smokes, here's a new one, and off I'll go.
So how can people help support the organization, Art for Aid?
We have an online store, the artforaidshop.ca. So as an artist, I use my art in two ways. So when I create a piece of art, I use the sales of the original artwork that I create go to pay my bills, because I'm a volunteer in this organization. I don't get paid. And I've never taken a salary. I've never taken anything for myself from this. 100% of it goes back to Art for Aid. So this year I started taking the money from my original art sales and putting that in my bank as per the advice of my accountant. And everything that I make from my art, all of the prints, the cards, the posters, all kinds of different stuff, we have for sale on our store. And 100% of the proceeds from our store go back to Art for Aid for shipping and operations. We also have what's really, really great for remote communities. I created Indigenous language posters in response to the COVID-19 calls to action. And when I started looking around at all the different posters they had to tell people to wash their hands and to keep distance and everything else, there was very little being represented for Indigenous language. And I thought that was quite a shortfall. And so I took some of my art and a few graphic design skills and created Indigenous language posters, one as a polar bear, the other one as an Indigenous woman sitting under a tree. And in, I think it's over 25 languages now, the posters say, wash your hands in the traditional language. And so those are available as a free download off of our website as well for anybody that wants to print those out. They're wonderful 16x20 high resolution posters, and they look fantastic. They're beautiful. They're wonderful art, and a nice piece of art catches the eye. And so when something like that can draw your eye, remind you to wash your hands, that is the best way to combat COVID-19, is to keep our hands washed. So that was sort of my way of meeting a need that wasn't being met. And now the government of Canada is using them. They're being circulated quite a big network. So that was quite a surprise. I was really happy about that. So people can download those as well. Go shopping at our store. We've got some really cool gifts in there. If people want to make a monetary donation and they need a tax receipt, I would suggest you go to ilovefirstpeoples.ca. You can donate in the go under programs and you'll see Art for Aid, and you can donate directly to Art for Aid, and they have that money put into a holding account for me that I can draw from when I do need it for shipping.
And I guess just kind of finally, why is it important to, you know, kind of inspire and encourage, you know, the next generation of artists, you know, giving opportunities to everyone?
Oh, man. Well, you know what? The next Daphne Ojig, the next Ron Neganosh, the next Norval Morisot, you know, these kids are all there. These artists, the spirit of these incredible Canadian Indigenous artists is alive and well in all of these children. But if you don't have the tools, you can't find that. You've got to have art tools in order to be an artist, to practice art. And a lot of these kids don't know what they can do because they don't have access to the tools. So I think by putting the tools in their hand, it allows them the ability to find that within themselves. Alex Janvier, you know, incredible Canadian Indigenous artist, one of the Indigenous Group of Seven. Daphne Ojig, same thing. I mean, and the list goes on and on, right? they, you know, I don't know what kind of supplies they had access to. I only know what kids don't have access to right now, and that's enough quality tools. So I think that if those tools are put into the hands of these children, you're going to find incredible creative crafts and art coming out of these communities. Birch bark biting, that's an amazing craft, and it's an endangered skill. You know, biting through biting with your teeth on birch bark and creating an incredible pattern. This is an endangered art form. Quill work, you know, these are all things that are important for kids to learn. And the elders and the arts people and the crafts people need to have the tools in hand to be able to teach them. So that's kind of the foundation of what I'm trying to do, is to put those tools into the hands of these kids so that they can tap into that incredible artist within themselves and share that with the world.
You can find out more from Art for Aid on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. We'll find out about Raven Trust from Susan Smitten, but first let's listen to some music from the Ethnic Music Concert Series from U Multicultural with Ray Coco Stevenson. Yeah!
I go by the name Pimose Mayingun, which means walking wolf in the Ojibwe language. That was given to me over 33 years ago when I started doing what I do with the drum, singing for ceremonies, different events, and all kinds of powwows all over the world. One of the things that I wanted to share with you also is that my name that was given to me at birth is Ray Stevenson, but I have a nickname. People call me Coco. And for over 33 years, I've been doing this singing. And tonight, I'm going to share a few songs that I've created over the years. And I have 7 different albums out on my own, not including the ones that I did with other people. But the very first song I composed is what I call my drum song. And I'll share that with you to start things off.
According to Raven, a registered charity, reconciliation needs to recognize the land our indigenous nations have been living on for centuries and recognize their rights. Susan Smitten tells us more about Raven and their mission to raise funds for Indigenous peoples' access to justice.
Sure. I am Susan Smitten. I'm the executive director at Raven, which is an acronym for Respecting Aboriginal Values and Environmental Needs. And that's our official name is Raven, Respecting Aboriginal Values and Environmental Needs. But everybody calls us Raven Trust because that's our website.
Were you there with the inception of the organization, or did you come on afterwards?
No, I built it.
You built it. Fantastic.
Yeah. So Raven turned 12 on April 1st. So in 2009, I was basically brought in by a board that had the idea of it a charity, and they had put the effort into getting charitable status, but they basically had a letter from Industry Canada saying, here's your tax number, you know, CRA. And do you think you could build this? So I took it on and, yeah, set about to creating what is now Raven.
Let's just kind of go over the details of what exactly Raven is and what you do.
It's kind of unique because we're the only, Raven is the only charitable nonprofit in Canada, and I think in North America, that raises legal defense funds to assist Indigenous nations who choose to enforce their rights in order to protect their land. And in doing so, they enforce their rights by going through the courts. And so we are fundraisers. Sometimes people get confused and think we're lawyers, but in fact, we're not. We are a team, fairly small team really, but of passionate fundraisers, communicators, who bridge that gap between the nations who launch the legal challenges and come to us and partner with us, and then the donors who want to stand with nations and to assist by providing the resources that they need.
Since there were no other services like this, like there was a void that needed kind of a filling.
I'm surprised that other organizations haven't started up because the demand is growing. When Raven started, we were just assisting two nations, Beaver Lake Cree Nation in north of Edmonton in the Lac La Biche area, and the Chilcotin, who were pushing back on a mine proposal by Taseko Mines. And it was just me. I was the only person. And so over time, we've grown to a team of 10, and we're working on 8 or 10 campaigns, and we've assisted something like 15 different nations now. But we're getting more and more requests for support. So I don't know that in the beginning, well, part of it was nobody knew Raven existed, and it took a while for us to build up any kind of track record. But I think now, with reconciliation being something that is supposed to be alive, but it's floundering, and nations are just taking to the courts because there hasn't been any actual tangible action from federal or provincial governments about land rights and returning land to the nations. The courts have become sort of that last place that they can go to. And so we actually have, yeah, I mean, the demand is there now. I don't know that it was right in the beginning, Brian, but it is there now and it's growing.
I know you're situated in Victoria, but do you work with nations across Canada?
Yes, we do. Yeah. We are actually, we've worked with nations in Yukon. We're just launching 2 legal actions in Ontario. We just got a request from a nation in Quebec. We've worked with nations in Alberta and we did predominantly work with nations in BC in the beginning because we were so small, you know, so that's where our reach was. Everybody was like, oh, did you hear about Raven? But, the word is out, I think, now, and so more and more people are hearing about the work that we have done, and we are getting requests now from coast to coast to coast.
Yeah, and hopefully we can help spread that message a little more.
I hope so. Yeah, it's awesome.
So I know you've touched on it a little bit already, but, you know, what is the importance and significance of an organization like this?
Real reconciliation has to have an underpinning in understanding that it's about the land and indigenous rights. And so that requires an upholding of those rights. And so the nations, though, to do that, you know, their rights are protected in the Constitution, right? In Section 35 of the Constitution. But there's one thing to have a right, and then another thing to be able to afford to uphold it in a court, especially when you're up against the deep pockets of the federal and provincial governments, right? So, I mean, who could do that? And so it's about access to justice, you know, and it's about making sure that the nations are thoroughly and well represented so that they have the best legal defense that they can have in terms of presenting their case. And it's interesting because I'm not a lawyer, but I'm, you know, learning a lot as we go along. And reconciliation actually has a meaning at law, which is, you know, reconciling the prior interests of the original landholders with this as yet unactually proven crown sovereignty. And so by using the courts, which a lot of people kind of go, well, the courts are a colonial system, and it's, yeah, and we agree, we're, you know, it's not necessarily the best possible system, but by allowing the nations to have access to it, they're actually going in and working to change the system from the inside out, right? They're reining in crown sovereignty by getting decision after decision that are upholding their rights, and in many cases now starting to acknowledge their indigenous laws as well. So that's why it's important.
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah, especially like our indigenous population's culture has, you know, basically been eradicated, pushed to the side. Like, now's the time to kind of protect it and protect our lands and these people, like, that have been, you know, historically taken advantage of.
I mean, decolonization, we got a long way to go, but, you know, that doesn't mean we shouldn't be doing absolutely everything we can to get there. And so part of that is acknowledging that the land belongs to the nations, and we need to, and when the nations make a choice to go to court, then we want to be there, and with the support of all of the donors. And interestingly, the donors are literally just grassroots. We get donations of, as you know, as little as $5 from people who want to give whatever they can because they understand that the burden on the nations is completely out of whack, and that we all benefit from the outcome.
Mm-hmm. And like you mentioned before, you can only work within the systems that are available. And then once you're in there, then you can help make a change to it.
Yeah. And I mean, I'm hoping that there will be a complete overhaul of systems. I think we need to, you know, the University of Victoria has the new combined law program of Indigenous law and Aboriginal, aka, you know, colonial law. And I think at a certain point the legal system will shift and begin to work in a different way. It's glacial at pace, I'm afraid, but I think it will have. I live in the hopes that it will, I will see this in my lifetime. But in that space, while we're waiting, we just have to work relentlessly to stop the harm and make things better.
Yeah, that seems to be the unfortunate side of, you know, social change and social, you know, developments. It always just happens so slowly, even though it's like things you're like, what, we need this now. It seems like straightforward.
Yeah. Yeah, I couldn't agree more.
You talked a little bit about, you know, the donors and grassroots groups that help make this all work. So exactly how does an organization like this work? What you know, what is all needed to make it run?
Well, passion and a lot of magic. Actually, we have a lot of magic happening over here, but it's, you know, that blend of the being rooted in the narrative that the nations share with us, and then using absolutely every possible way to get that message out. Thankfully, now, you know, now there's so many social media avenues, and we have a robust website, and then also and working to find and connect with donors. So we do pretty much everything we can to let people know that we're here, and that there are various ways they can donate online, you know, by check, by e-transfer, et cetera. But it's, and then we also apply for grants, and we don't take any government money. One of the things that Raven has stood on a principle of never applying for government funds, because we support nations that sue the government, and that.
Yeah, that would seem a little.
a little awkward.
Yeah.
Awkward. So, but we basically we have it set up so that people can donate, or they can. We also created peer-to-peer fundraising campaigns so that. People, we did that with the very first Pull Together campaign, which was the campaign we ran to support seven nations that were litigating to stop the Enbridge Northern Gateway pipeline. And our tagline was, who knew it could be so much fun stopping a pipeline? And we encouraged people to have parties and concerts and backyard barbecues and movie screenings and you name it, car washes, and raise $650,000for the nations. And so, it, you know, it requires systems that allow us to track donors. We have to be able to issue receipts. So we have a tax receipting thing here. It, you know, it's mostly just managing that space between the nations and the donors who want to support them. The funds come into Raven and we hold them in trust, marked for whichever campaign it's for. And then the nations send us their legal bills. They sign off on them, and then we just pay all of the costs.
How is ecological protection a part of Indigenous rights?
Things that we've been protecting are watersheds, right? The Peel watershed was protected by supporting three nations in Yukon and getting a Supreme Court decision that protected it. 80% of the Peel watershed, protecting the lakes from open pit mining, Fish Lake, the Chilt is the settler name, but Tultan B in Chilcotin territory has been protected from Taseko Mines open pit project. The nations that we supported, as I just mentioned, that were litigating stopped the Enbridge Northern Gateway pipeline from going through, and all of the potential spills on land and in water that could have, you know, and we've been working to support the nations that were litigating to stop the former Kinder Morgan, now the Trans Mountain pipeline, because of the threat to the ocean and orcas. And so there's, it's essentially in most of the ecological protection comes through the fact that the nations tend to go to court because there has been some state-sanctioned, potentially damaging industry, often, you know, mining the tar sands. And so it's about looking at what is the impact of that industry. And in many cases, the nations will say, look, we're not against mining, but we're against this project because look at the footprint it's going to have. Look at the legacy it's going to leave seven generations out. This is not sustainable. There has to be a better way to do this. That's part of it. And it's also about the lack of consultation and the fact that going to a nation and say, you know, and saying, hey, I was given this permit and this is my idea of consultation is telling you this is what we're going to do. That's not consultation. That's, you know, that's, well, there's lots of words for that, but probably none of them are good for radio. So, you know, so there's many layers to this, but so ecological protection is just something that, you know, the nations that we've been working with have been stewarding for millennia and we're also in that space between BC where there are very few treaties, almost none, and then the rest of the country where it's all under treaty. And so there is that issue that the treaties actually have a tension built into them because they promise the nations that sign them that they would have in perpetuity access to their traditional lands to hunt, trap, fish, gather medicines, and in perpetuity, right? Forever. However, the tension in the treaty is that there's an allowable taking up of lands by the government. And so the courts are still struggling to determine what's allowable and then what leaves the treaty still meaningful. You know, if you have to travel 250 miles to find a moose, is that a meaningful treaty, right? Not really. Or if the moose that you find is poisoned because it's been drinking water contaminated by tar sands industries, where's the meaningful nature of the treaty? So again, ecological protection is a multi-layered thing. And like I was just indicating, it's a very big topic.
Yeah, we could talk that's a big topic. Okay, let's talk a little bit about the impact of Raven, some of the victories that you've achieved in some of your ongoing and current campaigns that you're hoping to, you know, find some victories for our nations.
Yeah, well, I sort of alluded to them, but we did support three nations to protect in Yukon, protecting 80% of the Peel watershed. That was a land use planning issue. We've managed to protect Toltambi Fish Lake from the threat of an open pit mine that would destroy not just the lake, but the lake stands at the head of the major watershed that goes to the Chilcoot-Taseko and then Fraser Rivers. So protecting that amazing ecosystem. We have supported Beaver Lake Cree Nation now for basically 12 years. And while it seems, you know, like the tar sands continue to be taking over, and there is hope on the horizon there that there will be a reining in of that. And so some new campaigns that we have going on, we are supporting West Moberly First Nation in their legal action now against Site C, but it's against all three dams and the cumulative impact on their treaty rights. So hopefully there it will be a stopping of Site C, but also an opportunity to do some mediation of the environment. We're supporting two nations in Ontario. One is still not public, but we are supporting Niskantaga, which is in the Ring of Fire area, and over this road building problem that the Ontario government is trying to push forward. And so hopefully pushing that aside and establishing their jurisdiction to that territory. We're working with the Wet'suwet'en still, who have two legal actions in court. And we're basically waiting on judgment for, there've been a couple of hearings, so we're in a bit of a holding pattern on that one. So we have, yeah, there's a lot of campaigns actually on the go right now. We are very busy. Yes. Yes. And we'll be launching even yet another campaign for a nation here in BC regarding mining again and the impact of the Mineral Tenure Act and BC's adoption of DRIPA, which ties in with the UN Declaration of the Rights of Indigenous People. So there's some interesting legal precedents that we're hoping to be pushing forward.
I'll have to stay tuned.
Yes, you will.
So I also see that your website has a lot of information on there. You know, you have webinars and a podcast. So tell me kind of what is the kind of the hopes of, you know, putting that kind of information on there, and tell me a little bit about Raven's podcast.
Yeah. So we have a new podcast. We've just finished our second season. The podcast is Raven Debriefs, and people can pick it up anywhere you pick up your podcasts. We are sort of exploring the issues that are tangential or parallel to. So, for example, in season two, we just did a 3-part series on indigenous foodways. And so we focused on the granny gardens in Heiltsuk territory. Jess Housty talks about that. We focus on Ed Jensen, who's a Sequemec hunter, talks about, you know, helping to keep that the traditions alive, but bringing that into non-Indigenous communities. And then Nancy Turner, who's like world famous ethnobotanist, talks to us about a whole lot of amazing practices and you know, right from, you know, what would be on a food, what would have been on a table for an Easter dinner, you know, hundreds of years ago. So and the reason those are important is because that, again, is about the connection to the land. Why are we trying to protect the land? Because these systems are at risk if we don't. So things like that. And so, yeah, it's, we're really loving that. And we do, you know, with COVID, right, everybody had to pivot. So we've been pivoting to lots of webinars. We're partnering with different organizations. Like we have one coming up with Dogwood, and just really broaching different subjects. We had a fantastic webinar series with the people who were doing earth jurisprudence and around, you know, the laws, the Polly Higgins group. And so that was really amazing. So we're just looking at different ways to engage and get people to think about Indigenous rights, Indigenous laws, and the land in different ways. So, and one of the ways people can even just learn about what we do is we have a newsletter, so they can just sign up on the website and get our newsletter, which comes out now and then. So,
yeah, really exciting stuff.
Yeah, well, it's there are so many aspects to it, and we keep learning and growing. I mean, we're a growing organization, and we're learning all the time too. So we just want to share that with people, and hopefully our enthusiasm is maybe hopefully a little bit catching, and people want to learn more. And so that's what we encourage people to do. You know, one of the easiest ways to get involved with Raven is to just sign up for our newsletter and join in some of the webinars that we're teaching or leading. And then we're always open to talking to people. And
what are some other ways people can help and get involved?
Well, they can also, like in terms, if there are particular campaigns that they're interested in, you know, we have lots of businesses that have been joining and signing up. So for example, we're members of 1% for the Planet, and lots of businesses can create events or campaigns. You know, some amazing local businesses like Banditas Taqueria created a menu item for Raven, and every order that was of that item, you know, they donated a portion of that to one of the campaigns that we were running. Ernest Ice Cream did the same thing, where they created a flavor, and when people bought it, then, or, you know, they would donate a portion of the proceeds. People can just get very creative. So they can host an event. They can sign up and create a peer-to-peer fundraising event. We love it when people share what we do and tell other people about Raven, because, like I said, even after 12 years, we're still growing. And so it's sort of, we're beyond word of mouth, but it never hurts, right?
Oh, of course. It's never bad to have more people talking about your organization.
Yeah, and we just really love it when people show up at the webinars and share where they're at. We're just so grateful. Honestly, I think I want to share the fact that we're at most we are 10 people. Like if you mashed all of our hours down, we might be 7 people doing all this work. And we have an amazing board. We have a legal advisory panel that's fantastic, you know, and we just have this great team we're so grateful for. Actually, there is one thing I want to share. We just launched a new fund. It's an intervener fund because a lot of the nations want to sometimes intervene on larger legal actions. For example, like the BC bitumen reference, and we supported 3 nations that had an important voice that needed to be there. Well, now we've launched an intervener fund that caps out at 20,000 per nation. But we're looking at trying to create more ways that nations can access justice and in a fast and nimble way. So we're pretty excited about that. That's on our website. And also we have some really cool educational stuff on our website. And we're about to launch a new educational program that's going to be a 10-module thing. But on our website, we have a really cool project that's mapped that where we had the pro bono students at UVic mapped all of the major legal actions so people can go and learn about some of the legal precedents that have happened already. We have a lot of really interesting resources on our website that I would encourage people to just go and noodle around and find, and maybe there'll be something that really catches their attention, you know. Plus we have a lot of really interesting blogs and we're running a lot more Instagram lives. So there's those for people who are into listening to things.
Raven has recently launched an intervener fund, as many nations want to intervene on larger legal actions. Another way for nations to access justice. Raven is also launching a 10-module educational series. You can find details on Raven's funds, projects, and ongoing mission on their website at raventrust.com. Tune in to 101.5 FM every Tuesday afternoon at 1 to hear more stories and music from fantastic people across Canada. I'm Ryan Funk. This was U Talk, and have yourself a good one.